is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Friday, August 30th, 2019. I'm Buster Olney, and producing today, back at Bristol, Troy Farkas. The Arizona Diamondbacks are hanging on the fringe of the wild card race, even after trading Zach Greinke. And on Thursday, they played the Los Angeles Dodgers, and they did some damage.
Kelly sent the pitch. Fly ball, hit into deep right center field. Back of the warning track, back at the wall. It is gone into the pool. Three-run homer, Escobar. 10-4 Diamondbacks.
Greg Schulte, Arizona Sports, 98.7 FM. Yeah, the Diamondbacks on their way to an 11-5 victory over L.A. did a lot of damage against Hyunjin Ryu, and we'll be talking with Carl Ravitch coming up about what all that means. The Cubs and the Mets played on Thursday at Citi Field, a game the Mets desperately needed, and they had Cy Young Award winner Jacob deGrom on the mound. It was 1-1, top of the seventh inning, and Victor Caratini, who had homered off deGrom early in the game, came to the plate with two runners on base.
Swinging a drive to right field, down the line, it's got a chance, gone! Three-run homer, Victor Caratini. Cubs lead 4-1. His second home run of the game. This is the one that breaks the 1-1 tie, and the Cubs lead 4-1.
Pat Hughes in the Cubs radio network, and it might break the backs of the New York Mets. At the end of the day, the Mets in fifth in the race for the second wild card. They are five games behind the Cubs and also behind the Phillies, Brewers, and the Diamondbacks. Mickey Callaway, the Mets manager, talked about not giving up.
Like I've said all along, we got to continue to grind it out. These guys can do something special. I know they believe that. They show it every day. Even when we lose, they don't give up. I definitely believe it. I know our front office believes it. And the 40,000 fans out there, I think they believe it too. So we're going to continue to push and push and push until the end and see where we come out.
According to Fangraphs, as of this morning, the Mets' chances to win a wild card spot down to 13.7%. They're going to be playing on Sunday Night Baseball this weekend against the Philadelphia Phillies. Terry Francona, the Indians manager, was on Golic and Wingo on Thursday talking about the plans for Carlos Carrasco.
The way we've tried to go about it is, one, support him first and foremost and his family. Then when he started to get the itch to pitch again, you know, even throwing bullpens, it got us excited because you could see the difference in him and how much he enjoyed looking forward to it. He was back in the dugout because the guys love him. Then all of a sudden he's talking about coming back and joining us. And for me, that's icing on the cake. I mean, he will help us win games. There's no doubt about that. But just seeing him for what he's gone through, and then able to be happy and look like he's excited for something, man, I'll tell you what, man, it makes you feel good.
The reference, of course, was to Carrasco's battle with leukemia, which was discovered or revealed in June. And then at the All-Star game, the Indians players, Terry Francona, all gathered to honor Carlos Carrasco on the field, if you remember. The Indians and Tigers played on Thursday afternoon. The Indians carrying a 13-game winning streak against the Tigers, and they jumped all over Detroit in the top of the third.
And it's hit a ton to right. Back goes Demerit. He's at the wall looking up. It is gone. Frankie Lindor goes Apo. A towering home run to right by Francisco Lindor, and the Indians have a 1-0 lead.
Tom Hamilton, WTAM 1100, and that was pretty much all they needed because Mike Clevinger was tremendous.
Payoff pitch. Strike three called on a breaking ball that froze him. Clevinger will finish the day with 8 shutout innings and 10 strikeouts.
So the Indians win. What about the Twins? They face the White Sox, and C.J. Cron was among those who went deep.
As he hammers high and deep to center field. Back it goes near the track at the wall. That's gone. Twins go back-to-back. Cave now. Cron 8-0 in the third.
Corey Provis, Treasure Island Baseball Network. The Twins win 10-5, and along the way they set a major league record for home runs on the road in the season. Remember, we're still in August. They hit 3 in Thursday's win to lift their total to 140 away 141 away from home, and they're going to be adding on as we go through the month of September. Padres beat the Giants 5-3 with help from Manuel Margot.
Margot, high fly ball in the deep left center field. Car rushed. Ball going. Ball long gone. Manuel Margot. I said he had one lifetime home run against Eric Rodriguez. He was correct at the time. Now he has two.
Ted Leitner, 97.3 The Fan. The Pirates beat the Rockies 11-8. Kevin Newman had a big day.
And hits this high fly ball, hit deep to center field. Going back is Desmond, and it is gone! Goodbye, Newman again! He clears the deck with a cannonball, his second of the night, and what a night for Newman, and we're only in the fifth inning.
The Marlins edged the Reds 4-3 in 12 innings, but along the way, a Reds rookie set a record.
Duggar home with the 0-1 pitch. And Aquino socks one deep left field. It's way back, and it is gone! He's done it again! A two-run home run for Aristides Aquino. 2-0 Reds. It's number 14.
That is the record for home runs in a month. That from 700 WLW. Oakland, in a playoff race, of course, for a wild card spot, faced the Royals, and Jurickson Profar got a big hit.
To change up, sail toward right field, hit pretty well. Back is Dozier to the track at the wall, turns, and it is gone. Jurickson Profar, number 17 of the year, with Seth Brown aboard, and it turns the score the A's way. It's 3-2 Oakland.
And Oakland would hang on to beat Kansas City 9-8. That from 860 AM, The Answer.
Deep center field.
The game.
It's gone!
Of the day.
The game of the day in Houston. The Rays and the Houston Astros in the final game of that series. And Travis d'Arnaud gave the Rays a lead in the top of the fourth.
Breaking ball launched way up into the air to left. Turning and looking is Alvarez. And this one is gone, and I think it hit one of the windows. What a shot for Travis d'Arnaud. It cleared the Crawford boxes. Looked like the Albert Pujols shot back in the 04 playoffs.
That from 620 WDAE, Travis d'Arnaud continues to do damage for the Tampa Bay Rays. But the Astros would come back. Bottom of the sixth inning, Jose Altuve at the plate.
That's driven to center field. Garcia going back, still going back, looking up. See you later! Off the batter's eye! A home run for Altuve, his 25th, and the Astros are back on top. It's 6-5.
Robert Ford, KBME, 790 AM, Jose Altuve, red hot. But you know what? The Rays would come back.
Driven in the air to left center field. Springer chasing it back to the wall, and it's over his head. Two runs will score. Meadows is in. Pham right behind him. And G-Mon joined a second with a two-run double. And the Rays have an 8-6 lead in Houston.
And Tampa Bay would get a badly needed 9-8 win over Houston in the final game of that series. At the end of the day, Cleveland holds the lead for the first wild card spot in the American League. Oakland trails the Indians by a game and a half. The Rays are just a game behind Oakland, tied in the win column, but two games down in the loss column, Boston, 5.5 games behind Oakland. Before we start with Carl Ravitch, hiring used to be hard. Multiple job sites, stacks of resume, a confusing review process. But today, hiring can be easy, and you only have to go to one place to get it done. ZipRecruiter.com/Buster. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards. But they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address. ZipRecruiter.com/Buster. That's ZipRecruiter.com/BUSTER. ZipRecruiter.com/Buster. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Let's get to it.
All aboard. It's the Ravage Train with Carl Ravage.
Carl Ravage, the host of Baseball Tonight, of course, play-by-play man for ESPN, did a great job at the Little League World Series. Ravi, where's the Ravi train going on Labor Day weekend?
Robbie Tran heads to New York on Sunday for a Yankees-Rangers game on Monday. And we are all excited to be back talking about the big leaguers and the major leaguers. But to your point, we had a blast at the Little League World Series. Everything about it, to me, is what baseball, you know, should be. It's fun, which, again, baseball should be fun. The kids are great. The games are quick. The people involved with the broadcast all understand what it's about. So we had a great time. It succeeds every single year. It actually exceeds my expectations. And this was another year. And it's just funny. You get to see certain individuals, the way they play. We saw Profar's brother, who played alongside another kid who clearly looks like, you know, 5-10 years from now, he's going to be a major league shortstop. He's bigger than everybody else. And his footwork and his hands are terrific. And obviously, the team from Louisiana, whose stroke reminded everybody of Yelich's and things like that, and he squared every ball up. So it's a microcosm of what the big leaguers do, but it's a real neat look into, as I said, I think last week, the sort of universal language of baseball, and it's fun. It's fun to watch. You get a Curacao team playing a team from Louisiana. That to me is just really cool. I love that part of it.
Yeah, when I was interviewing Jurdrik Profar on the Little League Classic during that broadcast, in the back of my mind, I was like, you know what? I'm going to be talking to him in 15 years from now, and I'm going to be the old guy going, yeah, I remember when I talked to you back in the day. And he's going to look at me and said, I have no idea what you're talking about. But it was cool.
That's like Cody Bellinger. That was 07. That's not that long ago.
Yeah, exactly. All right, speaking of the Yankees, Jeff Luhnow, the general manager of the Houston Astros, had tremendous success in his role. He was on the Sean Salisbury show, and Carl, he said something that got a lot of attention in front offices around baseball. Give a listen to this.
And the it all starts with the rotation, and we do believe that to be successful in the postseason, we need to have a good, solid rotation, and they may not go as deep as they do during the regular season, but if you get six innings out of all those guys, you can piece together enough to win the game, and that's really what it's all about. So I'm thrilled right now. We're half a game behind LA for best record in all of baseball, and you know, I think we're going to pass them. I think we're going to pass the Yankees. I think we're going to pass them, because you just think about what we're putting out there every night, and like you said, Reddick getting hot now, and the rest of the guys, you look at the numbers that they've put up since the All-Star break between Altuve and Yuli and Bregman and Alvarez and Brantley. You've got five guys that are all been playing really well since the All-Star break, and now you throw Reddick into that mix, hopefully, and bring Correa back, and it's going to be a tough team to stop.
Yeah, and Carl, the reason why I played you the whole thing, because I wanted you to get the context of it, because the headline was, Astros GM says his team's going to pass the Yankees and the Dodgers, which is what got the attention around baseball. And listening to the whole thing, it's not really any different than Alex Cora saying, I believe in my team, or Aaron Boone saying, I believe in my team, or I think we're going to, you know, I feel good about where we are. But you just don't hear general managers say things like that. It's kind of like in spring training when Brody Van Wagener of the Mets was saying, come get us. And that's what I think got attention around the sport. But do you agree with me? I didn't think it was that big of a deal.
I don't. I think we in the media tend to play both sides of the coin. We are critical of those that don't say anything. And then when somebody says something, you know, it's taken to an extreme of, you know, big Joe Namath prediction, we're going to win the Super Bowl. Mark Messier guarantees a Stanley Cup victory in Game 7. There's nothing that he said that I wouldn't agree with. I think he's spot on. I think in a lot of ways he speaks like Theo Epstein, who I think at times can be very forthcoming and very honest. For all the analytics and sabermetrics and numbers that the Astros and other teams use, he reduces it to the simple fact of, I believe we have three starting pitchers who are studs, and I think our position players getting healthy are better than other teams' position players and pitchers combined. Therefore, I think we're going to have a better record when it's all said and done than the Yankees and Dodgers. And I wouldn't argue with him. I think he's right. I would agree with him. I think they finished with the best record.
And by the way, before that clip, he also complimented Wade Miley, and you know, and paraphrased his own manager, who said, you know, Wade Miley and the more famous guys. But Wade Miley has had a terrific season as well. But the other thing that jumped out, maybe what gets lost in that clip, Carl, and the conversation in baseball around it is This is a pioneer. Jeff is a pioneer with the work that he's done and the analytics that they've done. And the way that he has structured the Astros in the last four or five seasons is not a bullpen team. They rely like old school starting pitchers. This is what we try to build. This is why we traded for Justin Verlander. This is why we traded for Gerrit Cole. We're trading for Zach Greinke. And it kind of makes you wonder, as we move forward and they have so many bad bullpens around baseball this year, if the bullpen strategy is going the way of the wildcat in the NFL, where this might be the year where it's like, well, you know what, that doesn't really work. And maybe we should go back to getting starting pitchers to throw 100 and 110 pitches per game, and we can rely on those guys more. What do you think?
Well, I think he's touching on a subject that I think most general managers and, you know, team presidents and team owners, if you could have your druthers, this is sort of the discussion we've had for years around teams like the Yankees when you compare them with teams like the Astros. Would you rather have the Yankees bullpen or the Astros or the Nationals starting staff? And I think most would say, I'd probably take the starting staffs over a bullpen. And I don't think it's exclusive to the way Jeff Luhnow thinks. I think if you had your ability to have Kershaw, Strasburg, and Scherzer on your own staff, Cole, Verlander, whether it's a real good Wade Miley right now, Ryu, Kershaw, I think you would always defer to that if you can afford it and you have the ability to have them on your team at the same time than you would a bullpen. So I don't think it's anything unique. I think the idea that the Red Sox paid Chris Sale all that money, there's a recognition that if you can have that guy or multiple guys like that, you're going to be better off. By the same token, we go into every postseason and it's the starters who end up coming out of the bullpen because you really need three starters instead of four. And those guys bolster a bullpen that's probably taxed from a full season of work. I like the Astros. I think he understated the ability of those guys to give six innings. I think in a perfect world, they give them seven innings. Greinke maybe a little less than a Verlander or Cole, and then you're looking at two innings. But I'm telling you, when you do have those three guys, anytime the bullpen door opens, you're generally going to be on a team where you, as a fan of that team, get a little suspect as to who's coming out of it because your starter is so dominant, and now we're exposing, if not a vulnerability, we're taking a step down from a Verlander or a Cole. In the case of the Yankees, maybe you're stepping up, and it's a little different story. It depends on how your team is constructed, but I think to his point and to yours, anytime you can have three guys like that at the front of your rotation, and a lot of the good teams have at least two, if not three, you're in a better position than a team that relies on a bullpen. I think the postseason changes everything, and we tend to focus more on the bullpen numbers, but the bullpen numbers in the postseason aren't always ascribed to just the bullpen guys during the regular season. Nathan Eovaldi was a great example last year. We've seen Hill, we've seen Kershaw. We'll see starters come out of the bullpen, and it changes how we look at a quote-unquote bullpen.
Speaking of bullpens, Eric Carabel, ESPN.com senior writer, was on the Fantasy Focus Baseball podcast talking about the save and how it's kind of disappearing.
That's one of the big stories of this year that nobody's talking about. You're all talking about the home runs and all that, and you're studying the baseball. Study the saves. Teams are scoring so many runs that, like, save opportunities have to be going down. The fact that Boston scores all these runs and doesn't give Brandon Workman save chances, he's going to end up with 12 saves a season, and he's the primary closer. I think that's amazing.
Yeah, that's part of it. I also think that teams with closers are much more willing to sort of change guys from day to day than they used to be, but that is a byproduct, Carl.
Without question. And if, I think the state of negotiations for free agency has changed dramatically. I mean, look, what numbers, that we once relied on haven't changed and evolve. His point, your point's well taken. Save isn't relevant. Your whip is relevant all of a sudden, or at least within the last few years. And if you're a guy that can go in there and keep runners off base and keep runners stranded on base, that's how you're going to have to take your case to, or whether it be arbitration or to a team, and say, of course you need this guy, because not only can he close, but he can pitch in the sixth or seventh inning. And look, Little League and Major League Baseball have little in common other than the bat, the ball, and the fact that you're playing on a field. But we saw at the Little League World Series, one of the teams that ended up winning the whole thing, they did go to, at that point, who was their best arm in a situation where it was the fourth inning. We need to stop this now. The point is, the closer, the save, the win, a lot of things that once were a high priority are changing. But it doesn't, to me, take away from who's the guy I trust. In the end, I need to know that when that door opens and he's coming to the mound, whether it's the seventh inning, the eighth inning, or the ninth inning, I have great faith that this situation is not going to overwhelm him. That's what I'd pay for, because the save thing, to me, continues to become what's the highest leverage part of that game. And I think we all who have followed baseball for a long time can look at a situation when we're leading by two runs, they have two men on, and the 2-3-4 guys are coming up, and it's the seventh inning. We got to stop this now, and we need to have that door open and have the most trustworthy guy come out of that door. I think that's the direction we're going, and Eric's point about the save being reduced and all that, that's the direction the game is going in, and as a result, the number of saves a particular individual has is likely to go down unless you fall in an organization where they stick by their sort of old school guns. I got a sixth inning guy, a seventh inning guy, an eighth inning guy, and here comes my closer, Chapman.
And you know what's funny is that in arbitration, the guys with the saves get rewarded. You get rewarded for saves. Edwin Diaz is coming off a terrible year with the Mets. He's, he's been a disaster for them. But because he had a lot of saves when he was with Seattle, he's going to get rewarded for that, which is why agents and folks in front offices are saying, we need to upgrade. We need to get present day with that part of the arbitration system. All right, I want to ask you, I want to save some time here to talk about the Mets, who lost again yesterday. They went through a great stretch in the earlier part of August, but they've now been swept in back-to-back series, first by the Braves, then by the Cubs. According to Fangraphs, their playoff chances are down to about 13%. And look, on the days leading up to the trade deadline, Carl, watching the Mets was like having those moments that all parents can relate to, where you're watching your son or your daughter doing something. You're like, don't do it. Don't think about it. You better not do it. That's a bad decision. And that's what I remember thinking when I was hearing that, yeah, the Mets are not going to sell. They're going to actually try to buy. And they did it. Okay, and now it's apparent that the big Hail Mary play is probably not going to pan out for them. And to review where they were on July 27th, which is the day they made the Stroman deal, their chances for a wild card spot that day, Carl, 7.2%. The chances for a division title, 0.6%. And there is enormous cost in doing this. Because now, because the value they didn't get for guys like Zach Wheeler, the potential value in a Noah Syndergaard, the value in Edwin Diaz, and he had some trade value before the deadline, that's gone. Because he's going to make over $7 million next year, and it doesn't look like he probably is going to have time to recover. And on top of that, my God, the amount of salary they now are looking at for the rotation, Jacob deGrom will make $25 million next year, a big jump for him, almost threefold. If they want to keep Zach Wheeler now, they'd have to give him $18 million in a qualifying offer. Syndergaard's going to jump to $12 million. Steven Matz is going to jump to about $6 million. Stroman's going to be $12 to $13 million in that range. They already have the fourth highest number of dollars in payroll commitments for next year. And you know how the Mets do business. They don't necessarily wind up having one of the biggest payrolls. The future cost, the credit card mentality, this will devastate this team moving forward. It was a mistake at the time they did it. I know they went through a run. I know they had some fun days. And maybe they can reprise that to some degree. But, man, this was a bad bet. You know, the comparison I made here on the podcast was someone with a pair of twos going all in with their stack of chips. It made no sense. And now the cost is right in front of them. What do you think?
Well, I think You and I would disagree on the pair of twos. I'd probably have it closer to maybe a pair of nines. I was one that thought the aggressive approach would pay off. And, you know, initially against the subpar teams, it did. And there was an energy and a buzz. And I think collectively, when you looked at the names on that roster and the problem, you know, one of the problems that they have that many teams do, it's not exclusive to the Mets or injuries. When you have, you know, Cano and Cespedes, who doesn't, he's like Ellsbury, he's kind of in the witness protection program. You know, I think it adds to it. I agree with you, but I think in the end, the Mets are either going to have to change the way they do business, or to your point, that this will cost them for the foreseeable future. They're doing a lot of things publicly now, behind the scenes, with regards to their scouting department, which I think is a reflection of, to your point, we're all in on Brody Van Wagenen. Now, whether you think Brody's a two, you know, or a 10 or an ace of spades, that's up to interpretation. And there's probably more people very skeptical about him than there are optimistic about the decisions he's making. But if you're the Wilpons, you've kind of made your bed here. And the knee-jerk reaction is not going to be, you know, in a year in which we flirted with it here in August, and now September looks like it's not going to be a great month for us, and October obviously is not going to exist for us. They're not going to get rid of Brody Van Wagenen. They clearly have stood behind him, and now they are going to either suffer the consequences or benefit from his bravado, and we'll see what direction it goes in. But I understand your point. And again, I was a little more bullish on the team than you were with the two twos, but I'm open to the idea that this whole thing is going to backfire. I don't doubt that. But gosh, if they change the way they do business and they're willing to spend more money, I'd go into next season hoping guys are healthy and a staff that is damn near the best in Major League Baseball. We just ran a soundbite from Jeff Luhnow. If you could have three starters like we do, well, they'd have them. They'd have more. Going into a season and assuming health into a postseason, we have as much ability and talent as anybody.
Yeah, your point is dead on this. Look, Brody Van Wagenen got that job because he told ownership that he could win now and that he could make moves that could win now. That was the mandate from ownership when he came on board, and you're right. The way to make up for that win-now impetuous type of movement is to spend more money. And they're going to have to because, again, look at big picture. The plans for the 2021-2022 Mets. Stroman will be eligible to reach free agency next fall. Syndergaard and Mats will reach free agency the year after that, which means in 2022 – when you look at the Mets, you're going to have like a 34-year-old Jacob deGrom and four empty spots after they've strip-mined the farm system. Like, it, long-term, it's ugly.
Again, I wouldn't argue with that. And I think it's important to have long-range thinking. I think the Wilpons, like many other ownership groups, are into putting people in the seats and collective bargaining agreement on the horizon. There's a bit of uncertainty as to what direction this whole thing goes and what the what the basis is going to be for salary structure and all those things that make up the current CBA are likely to change. And I need to be focused on the immediate when I have the level of talent, especially on the staff that I do, more so than I am what's going to happen in 2023. The other part of the equation, I think, that has changed rather dramatically, which will speak to the CBA, is the impact that kids are having on the game. And I don't mean Little Leaguers, but I do mean those that are 6 years removed from Little League age. You're talking about 18 and 19-year-olds. Those guys are different, or at least the acceptance level of those guys is different. The idea that today the Mets farm system is not what other farm systems are doesn't mean to me that in the next 2 years it couldn't change dramatically, and whoever that person or people are could have an impact in 2023 and 2024. If for no other reason, we see it on other organizations now that are heading towards the postseason.
see the Braves, see some of the Astros kids, see the Nationals. So, look, I'm not denying that, we could be having this conversation in 2023 and 24, and we're looking at them the same way you have at the Royals recently. It's been terrible. But it could also go the other way. And you know me, Buster, glass half full guy.
There you go. Yeah, as you're mentioning teams and say, look, you know, teams with good prospects like the Mariners with Jared Kelenic and Justin Dunn.
No, I hear you.
Guys, they got in the Cano deal. All right. Thanks, Carl. I appreciate it. Have a great weekend.
Thanks. See you soon.
The Mendoza Line with Sunday Night Baseball's Jessica Mendoza.
And this Sunday, Sunday Night Baseball, we've got the Mets in Philadelphia. Jess, how you doing this morning?
I'm doing good. I'm a little tired on the West Coast, but that's not a bad thing.
Well, so let's inject some adrenaline into this. Look, you're in your first year working with the Mets, in addition to what you're doing with us on Sunday Night Baseball. I just got done talking with Carl Ravitch about what's happened to the Mets in last week. First off, back-to-back sweeps at the hands of the Braves and then the Chicago Cubs. Just tell me what you're seeing in the team right now.
You know, obviously frustration, and I think, you know, coming out of the trade deadline, the second half of the season, the All-Star break, so much hope, just a different team. And not that it was just Marcus Stroman coming over, and you know, but I think just the idea that this team had a lot of faith in the front office from the entire organization that they were good enough and could be good enough to get to the postseason, and the run that they went on after that, I think then to get swept, especially coming off sweeping the Indians, getting swept by the Braves, so then it just adds this pressure. And really what we've seen, Buster, with the NL wild card is how closely knit all of these teams are. It's one thing to say, okay, the Mets are two games back and they're so close to being the wild card, but then it's another added pressure when it's like you're two games back at that point with three or four teams all around you that at any minute could pass you. And I just feel like that kind of pressure, you can use it to push you and motivate you and get you through, and I think that's what we saw for a good 2-3 week span. And I think once this Mets team got swept by the Braves, the pressure coming in with the Cubs, especially after the first loss, it got to Noah Syndergaard, to Jacob deGrom, the big hits. And you could just kind of see on the players' faces, like, I feel like last night especially was the most important game of the season. You got your ace on the mound just to stop the bleeding of, okay, let's get to September. Let's make sure that we're contending in September. By the way, that's Sunday, right? So just let's get to this Philly series. And you've got your ace. And then after Caratini hit that second home run, I just felt like the entire team was like, this was the most important game of the season.
Yep. And look, there's a month to play, and it's not like the Mets are chasing immortal teams. And, you know, you mentioned how closely packed together all these wild card contenders are, and part of it is because none of them are great teams. And so there's an opportunity ahead of them. But as we talked about, Fangraphs, you know, assesses the Mets' playoff chances at 13%. Before the trade deadline, the time they made the Stroman deal, it was around 7.5%. I thought it was crazy then that they bought. Feel today it was just as crazy. I'm concerned about the long-term cost for the organization. Look, these are not your decisions, but I'm curious about your read on sort of what the perspective of the front office was in making those moves.
Well, being around the team, being around Brody, being around the front office heading into the trade deadline that week, you know, the plan wasn't, hey, we're just going to go buy win today. It was, how can we, if we know that there's a possibility we're going to lose Zach Wheeler and Jason Vargas to free agency at the end of the season, how do we go and replace two pitchers to make sure that we are going to win in 2020? And so the idea was to go and acquire a pitcher now, thinking about the offseason and where the free agent market and the trade market, and at the time, remember, you were hearing all the pitchers, you know, Trevor Bauer, Mike Minor, Matt Boyd, Marcus Stroman going to different teams. So in the mind of the Mets, if those pitchers all get traded to other teams and then you go into free agency and you've got the price of Gerrit Cole, Madison Bumgarner, you know, so many of the free agents being too much, how do you replace guys like Zach Wheeler and Jason Vargas when the market could possibly be already gone at that point, I think was the mindset. And knowing that the objective, as everyone knows, for the Mets, it's not going to be a rebuilding year. It's always going to be trying to win for the next year. So I think the idea of buying was to also, you know, replace guys, but then to even turn around and sell to be able to build for next year. Where I credit Brody is he didn't just give in to any trade, you know, seeing a lot of the offers that were out there. And I think that's why we saw guys like Trevor Bauer, Mike Minor, Matt Boyd, so many pitchers not get traded. When I thought, and I think a lot of people thought, that the trade market would be, it was a seller's market. I saw that change very quickly to where no one was willing to give up their biggest names. And not even their biggest names, but like we're talking number two, number three prospects, guys especially that are going to come up within the next year or so versus, you know, one that might be 4 or 5 years out, which we all know is a huge risk, especially for the Mets that want to win next year. So anyway, kind of a long story short, that's the mindset of the Mets. It's about winning next year. It wasn't so much coming out of the All-Star break being like, we will win this year, even though they started to do that. It was really about, hey, we're not going to lose out if we lose two of our pitchers on this pitcher's market for 2020.
Now, both the Mets and the Phillies this year have been helped out by older coaches. Phil Regan was installed as the pitching coach, you know, at 82 years old. I covered Phil in his year as manager in Baltimore Orioles 1995, and I, you know how progressive he is. I know how open-minded he is. He managed for years in winter ball, which gives you some perspective. He just didn't take the winter off. He went down and he would tell great stories about that. So you knew that he's a pliable personality. And Charlie Manuel, of course, is, as a executive said to me this week, he's just a great dude. Like, everyone loves Charlie Manuel, and it seems like they're both having an impact.
Yeah, and I think, you think about where the game of baseball is right now, Buster, and that it's all about youth, and whether that's driven on who gets paid the most, who's talked about the most, how analytics factor in age. And I get that's the players, but I feel like, gosh, if you're over the age of like 35 these days, like, you're done. You can't be a part of a game. It's over. And, you know, I joke, but when it comes to coaches, I feel like that stereotype is also there. And I appreciate the fact that you can see Phil Regan, Charlie Manuel, Phil obviously being 82 years of age, Charlie being 75. And from what you hear from the players from the Mets, the hitters from the Phillies, is just this open-mindedness, this kind of ease and simplicity of the game. Because I'm just as guilty as anyone. What comes a lot of times with all the numbers and the technology now is just a ton of information. And I think for a lot of these players, whether it's a pitcher on the Mets side or a hitter on the Philly side, there's such a relief when it can just be kept simple again. When you kind of just get back to do what you do. The numbers are still there. Technology is still there. I think Phil has done a really good job of balancing both within the Mets organization. And the results have showed, barring, of course, the last few nights when the Mets have given up a lot of runs, but if you look at just their numbers second half to first half, you can see there's a real difference, and I really give Phil part of that credit and his team that he's brought in.
Yeah, and just knowing Charlie and his personality, you can tell he's like someone you would naturally relax just being around him. He puts you at ease because that's just his personality. I want to ask you about two teams we saw last weekend, the Yankees and the Dodgers, who are battling for the best record in baseball along with the Houston Astros. And I got to tell you, and look, the Yankees won the game on Sunday, so there's some recency bias there for me. But, you know, we saw Kenley Jansen over the weekend struggle, and then he blew another save the other night. Hyunjin Ryu's been knocked around in recent starts. I got to say, I walked away from that series thinking, you know what? I think the Yankees are the better team. What was your take?
Yeah, and I actually started to rethink, you know, who I believe might come out of the postseason from the National League. And not to just be off of one series, be like, okay, the Dodgers aren't the best team, absolutely, in the National League. I think they still are today. I do believe that when they're challenged, and that's what we saw with the Yankees pitching, with their offense, with the way they work counts, really just postseason baseball. And I mean, Buster, we were there, those games, right? Didn't they feel just like, you know, 10 steps higher? You know, I've been to Dodger Stadium a million times. Yeah. The crowd, just all of it. And you can't judge the Dodgers' entire postseason on one series, but I do believe that I started to look, I'm not kidding, at the Washington Nationals, who are a wild card team right now, and think about, okay, if they're a wild card team and they got Scherzer for that one game, and then they end up facing, which would be the Dodgers, in a division series, it's not a shoo-in that the Dodgers are going to even make it to the championship series. So anyway, I hate being like beat up on them going from this is the team that's going to come out of the National League to being, I don't even know if they make it to the championship series, but I really did believe, Buster, that told us a lot of where this team is now and how they can handle big pressure, better teams, better pitching, situational hitting, not chasing, all the things that are going to come in October. Good thing is for them, it was in August. And now they have a chance to go back and be like, okay, how can we get better for games like that? Forget the regular season games right now that we're dominating everyone. How do we get better for October situational hitting, being able to do all the things right that we didn't do in that series?
And one thing I talked about in the podcast yesterday, and I want to run this past you, to that end, if you're the Dodgers, and the whole month of September is going to be about preparing for the postseason, I feel like that Dave Roberts should call his good friend A.J. Hinch and said, hey, A.J., back in 2017, the postseason, when Ken Giles became ineffective, you basically blew it up, your plan, and you just audibled every day through the postseason with your bullpen. How did you do that? Because I feel like that's something the Dodgers need to start preparing for now, to have that. Let's face it, it would be an explosive situation, you know, with Kenley, and because he's so accomplished and he's so proud. And you have to get him open-minded to the idea of, look, we're going to try different things. We got to make sure we get some safety nets in place because we have so much at stake this year.
Well, and to keep, like, your overall, the psyche of the team together, knowing Kenley, you know, can have such an influence. And it's funny you say that, and I think that's a great suggestion if A.J. would give up all that information to try to help someone like another baseball down the road. But it's funny because when we met with Dave Roberts on Sunday before our game, I actually grabbed him as everyone was leaving and asked him just that. I was like, you know, I'm curious, like, is there a chance that Kenley, and mine wasn't so much like, okay, you remove him completely, but I'm like,
right,
do you foresee in October Kenley maybe not being used in the ninth, that maybe Kenley ends up being a piece, you know, in the seventh, in the sixth, where he's not your closer, where you can put in, you know, because you have these starting pitcher options, you have other things that you don't have today that you will have in October. And he's like, yeah, we've actually started to look at that. And like, have you had those conversations with Kenley? He's like, not yet. And I think we're going to kind of evaluate and see. But I could tell, and you know how Dave's facial expressions are.
Yeah.
But, you know, just the look on his face, that this is definitely something they have thought about. And they're trying to figure out without saying, absolutely, this is going to be an issue and we need to figure it out. But he's like, no, this is something we're talking about for sure right now.
And it's on the front burner for sure as we go into the last month of the season. Jess, thanks for doing this. I will see you at the ballpark tomorrow.
See you in Philly.
Bleacher Tweets.
Rhea Wong is known on Twitter as Rena Benina, a Twins fan who helps us out with the Bleacher Tweets. Rena, you got big plans for the Labor Day weekend?
A little bit, yeah. So up here in Minnesota, we have cabin culture. And so it's essentially against the law to not go to your cabin during Labor Day weekend. So I'll be spending a lot of time at the cabin on the lake, making a pit stop at the state fair on the way. But that's pretty much it. It'll be a great relaxing weekend. Nice little second vacation from last week.
Yeah, my favorite thing at the state fair was always the tractor pull growing up. I love the tractor pull and the oxen pull at the Tunbridge Fair in Vermont. Will you be following the Twins on radio or television over the weekend?
Thankfully, television. We actually installed a Fire Stick and got really great Wi-Fi up at the cabin so that I can watch the Twins games.
See, here's the thing. I definitely prefer radio. I love listening to games on the radio, but I, you know, my son is the same way that you are. He's like, why would I listen on radio? I'd much rather watch on television. Anyway.
See, love the radio, too. I just can't find one. I can't find one anywhere. I don't know where to get them anymore.
All right, let's get to this week's Bleacher Tweets.
Sounds good. Kicking things off, we've got Terry Hainu at Terry Hainu. Out of all the three division races still open, which one is the most likely to be won by a team not currently in first place? Sorry in advance, at Rena Benina.
Yeah, so taking a shot at you there, being a Twins fan, holding a lead over the Cleveland Indians. I think the division that's wide open still is the National League Central. The Cardinals lead the Cubs by two in the loss column, but keep in mind, seven of the last 10 games for these two teams are against each other down the stretch. And that means that, you know, as long as they stay within range, either team can win that division. What do you think?
Yeah, I fully agree. And I think it'll also come down to just whatever team's the hottest at the end of September. I think the Twins have a slightly easier schedule than Cleveland for the rest of the season. But I think the NL Central is still wide, wide open as well. Moving on, we've got the Bill Chuck Files at Billy Ball. After listening to Prince Fielder and earlier in the week, Junior Griffey, and with all the kids in the majors this season, who do you think is baseball's best father and son duo of all time?
Yeah, it was Ken Griffey Jr. and his dad, Ken Griffey Sr., who was a great player and part of those great Reds teams in the 1970s. You know, put up big numbers, and his son, of course, is a Hall of Famer. So that to me, that's a tough duo to beat. What do you think?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. In terms of baseball vitality, I mean, there really isn't any competition. But I do think that the Boone clan is also fairly interesting. I mean, Bob and Aaron both went on to have really significant careers after baseball, whether that's managing or broadcasting. But, I mean, in terms of best baseball duo, definitely the Griffeys. Next, we've got Mark Sherman at Shark Merman. As of right now, the Twins have 261 home runs, and the Yankees have 250 home runs. Do you think the Yankees can catch the Twins and defend their home run record?
And they've made up a lot of ground. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it felt like about 3 weeks ago they were down by like 30, 35 home runs, something in that range, and now they've cut it down that far. But I think the Twins are going to hold on. And, Rena, you know this. The Twins have the easiest schedule down the stretch. They are going to beat up on these bad American League Central teams.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Yankees have the Orioles, but we have the Tigers, the Royals, and the White Sox to beat up on. So I don't really see it happening. Next, we've got Darren Wong at DWong underscore. What do teams execs think of the juiced baseball? Has it changed their thinking, and how does it make their jobs easier or harder?
Yeah, Darren, I wrote about a column about this earlier this season because I was already hearing from executives that, yeah, it does complicate the conversation because somebody who takes a big jump in home runs this season, how do you evaluate that player this winter? And it's not going to be based on the home run numbers. It's going to be based on exit velocity, on ballpark factors, a lot of underlying metrics is what I'm hearing. But I think the great question that hangs over the sport is there going to be an adjustment back the other way? In other words, is the ball suddenly going to be softened up for next year? I'm sure the Player Association will be keeping track of that as well.
Absolutely. And rounding out the week, we've got T. Jones making his second consecutive appearance at TNJ 629. Who's on your Twins Mount Rushmore? Mine is Puckett, Viola, Santana, and Herbeck.
Okay, Rena, I need a ruling from you. Are the Washington Senators in play here in this conversation?
I'd say yes. Yep.
Okay, well, then you have to start with Walter Johnson, who's in the conversation for the greatest right-handed pitcher of all time. I would have number two, Rod Carew. I would have Harmon Killebrew, and I would have Kirby Puckett. All those guys are Hall of Famers. With all due respect to Joe Mauer, that would be my four. What about you?
I would have to put in Joe Mauer.
And you're putting in, I'm guessing, let me guess for a second. Let me just take a guess. You're going to put him in place of Harmon Killebrew?
No.
Oh, okay.
No. I would keep Killebrew, Carew, and Puckett. I'd slide Joe Mauer in fourth.
You're taking Walter Johnson out? Walter Johnson's one of the greatest pitchers ever.
I am. My personal, I guess, deciding factor was I wanted to pick players with retired numbers by the Twins. I think that if you get people to go to Mount Rushmore and they see someone who doesn't have a retired number, tongues will wag. And also, this is a really great way to get the young millennials out to the Mount Rushmore of the Twins to go see Joe Mauer and take their selfies or whatever they want to do out there.
Yeah, I might have to ask Tim Kirchin, a graduate of Walter Johnson High School. Rena, thanks for doing this.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Thanks today to Rena Wong, Carl Ravitch, Jessica Mendoza, and Troy Farkas. And before we go, I want to say this. This week, Blake Bibbins, a prospect in the Rays system, suffered the worst imaginable tragedy. His wife, Emily, 14-month-old son, Cullen, and mother-in-law Joan Bernard were all murdered, and his brother-in-law is in custody. Blake Bibbins posted these words on Instagram yesterday. My life as I knew it is destroyed. The pain my family and I feel is unbearable and cannot be put into words. I shake and tremble at the thought of our future without them. Everybody in baseball is thinking of Blake and his family.